Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We open the show learning about incredible pepper and salt mills, unlike any you've ever seen. We'll follow that up with some fun Shakespeare. You heard that correctly. At 10, national correspondent Bob Ney joins us, followed by a report on rainbow trout heading to Vermont waters from the West Coast. And we finish the morning leaping into some EVs. But first, let's meet the creator of Holzkopf Pepper Mills. Joining me now is Detlef Hunsdorfer, who is creating these beautiful pieces here in Vermont from local and exotic hardwoods. Detlef, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick, and thanks for having me.
Good morning. We're happy to have you. Listeners, to ask Detlef about the pepper and salt mills he creates, you can call us at 802-244-1777. 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And while we're speaking, you can also visit Holzkopf-DH.com to check out what he makes. Now, Detlef, what does Holzkopf mean, and why did you choose it for your company name?
Holzkopf is interesting word in German. I have German background. My father used to call me this. It is kind of translates to the English word bonehead, but it has a way nicer meaning. It's when you did something wrong, and but it wasn't that significant. He said, "Oh, do Holzkopf. You should have done this and that." So that's how I got into this, and I kind of like used his expression as a business name.
I get it. I remember Kopf meant head in the German I took in high school, and I remember there was the golfer Tom Weiskopf, which means white head. So I knew that part of Holzkopf, but I didn't know it meant bonehead. When and why did you become a woodworker?
I started maybe 15 years ago, kind of using the workshop, wood shop, as a little bit as a hobby to relax and kind of spend some time making something when it was dreary outside and nobody wanted to go out in November. So I picked up a wood turning class and I started making some bowls and platters, and I wasn't really any good at it. So I combined my other little hobby, which is cooking, and I said, hey, why don't we make some pepper mills which actually work and which even on top of that also look nice.
Don't they ever. They are beautiful designs. What had you been doing in your career before woodworking?
I was a professional fashion photographer.
No kidding.
We were traveling a lot, and we live in Vermont since 89, and we never spent a full year in Vermont because most of our jobs were on locations in sunny areas in the U.S. and worldwide. So that's when we came home that I really didn't work when we were home, and that's when I started fiddling with wood, which I like because my grandfather used to build furniture, and my dad used woodworking in the same manner to relax and spend some time away from the job.
So you said you started, like most, the turning wooden bowls, and then you found your way to these pepper mills. But I know you enjoy cooking, but that's kind of a big leap, going from a bowl to these pepper mills that you create. So how did this become your thing, building these pepper mills?
I actually got pretty annoyed with all the pepper mills I could buy. Because most of them weren't really working, and they all kind of looked similar. And so I stumbled over this hardware to make pepper mills, and then I tested several different hardwares because there is a lot of hardware on pepper mills out there, which after a few months or years doesn't work. So I haven't had any problems with my hardware. So that's why I said, hey, let's do something, make some nice peppermills, and then it kind of got out of hand, and I didn't do anything else than peppermills.
I think if you look on Detlef's website right now, there are, I believe, 67 different styles available to purchase right now. How long did it take you to perfect the method that you use now to create these?
I mean, it's getting... I took probably a couple of years to come up with a process and a final way of doing it, so they would last and nobody would ever complain, oh, it's not working or so. So it maybe, yeah, I'm guessing 2 years was about it. Mm-hmm. And it is also one thing, your designs evolve. You kind of... We did a vacation on Prince Edward Island, for example, and my wife said, look at all the lighthouses up here. And then later that day she said, why don't you make lighthouse peppermills? So I tried that one, and they are fun to do, and people like them. So it's a process.
Yeah, and... I want to look at the life of a Holzkopf peppermill. So first of all, where does the wood come from that you source for these mills?
Some is coming actually from our own backyard. Every other ice storm kills a couple of white birches, and I just cut them down and I let them dry for 3-4 years, and then I use that as the wood. And then the other thing is I love exotic woods as well, and they are hard to find. So I have a supplier here in Burlington where I go once a month and check out what's new, what I haven't been working with. And so it's a mixture of Vermont local hardwoods and stuff I can get from the treehouse, actually, here in South Burlington.
Now, I know you mentioned... white birch. I know you use maple. What are some other different types of woods, especially the exotics that you use in these various pepper mills that you create?
I fell in love a little bit with a wood called padauk, which is very red in color. Mm-hmm. And if you combine that one with local Vermont maple, you have a lot of style options where peppermills starting to become to look like little sculptures, and that is one of the woods I like. And then there's another one. I call it snakewood. It actually, the regular name is lacewood. Mm-hmm. And if you turn that into a round object, the look of the wood reminds you of a snake, and that is also a very interesting thing.
Now, you used a term, a phrase there. You said, you combine the wood of this with that. Now, this isn't like cooking where I can combine flour and salt and egg and create something. These are woods. So explain how you do that, how you blend or meld these different types of wood when creating something like that, the walnut maple lacewood salt and pepper set, which is stunning.
It starts out with finding the boards, and then I laminate them together before they even go on my lace. Mm-hmm. So and as much as you can sandwich together, you can make mills out of 5-6 different kinds of woods. And after that is done, then the turning process starts, and then the form takes shape. And that is always the thing. You don't really know in the beginning how the final result is going to look like.
Mm. And you can watch a video of that lathe, that work, at Detlef's website. And again, that's holzkopf-dh.com. Let's go to North Face and take a call from Cindy. Hi, Cindy. Go right ahead.
Hi, good morning. Good morning. I'm so glad to have you interviewing this fella. I used to have a salt and pepper mill that was both in one. Like, you'd turn the top.
Oh, right.
Oh, I don't know. I lost it somewhere along the line. It's been years, and I loved that thing. And it was made out of I think it's made of different kinds of wood, but it was a salt and pepper grinder at the same time. You know, the salt was on the top, and you could grind the salt, and then the bottom was for the pepper. And I was wondering if you've ever made a design like that.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Detlef?
I never made a double mill with grinds both. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of versions where the pepper is a grinder and the salt is a shaker, which is built into the top turning knob. I haven't seen any hardware which would allow me to grind both yet. I'm still on the look for that because I have a lot of people asking, is there something which does both?
Interesting.
But it must be out there. I haven't found it yet. Most of those are commercial productions where they actually design their own hardware. But that is a little bit past my abilities.
Gotcha. You stick to the woodworking, Detlef. Now, Detlef, once you've got the wood bonded, I don't know if that's the correct term. I might be making it up, but... How do you then form this block of wood into the pepper mill? And some of them have such curves and unique designs.
After it's bonded, it is a rough square, and I pre-drill the center for the hardware, which is going to be put in after the mill is done. And then it goes on my lathe, which turns at a fast speed, and I use tools to shape and round everything over. The process sometimes is straightforward when you're looking at very sleek and modern designs, but some of the curves take a long time to get them right and to get them fine. And then once the shape is done, then it all gets sanded down while still spinning at a high speed. And then afterwards, it gets finished with some food safe oil, and that is the process. But how it's going to be looking like, I can't tell you unless I start it and see what the wood actually shows me.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Now, you've got things like butternut oak and sapele maple. And that probably is my favorite combo, that sapele maple. Are there some combinations of wood that really work well together, some that don't work well together?
Yeah, it's mainly a question of color and contrast. Mm. If you combine woods which are pretty similar, then you kind of lose the ability to make a nice shape which is visible from afar when it's sitting on the table.
Yeah.
So I like to work with contrasting woods, being light wood and dark wood, combine them to give certain looks.
Now, another one that I thought was stunningly unique and beautiful is the silver-plated maple. Describe that one for people.
That is a thing I started actually a year ago, where I basically shaped the mill to its almost final look, and then I use real silver and plate the wood with it. I already also have done gold, and it is a very
yeah.
you gotta know what you're doing. I had a lot of mishaps in the beginning, but after a little while, you find out how it is, and it gives another dimension to how the looks can be.
So you came from an artistic background, being a photographer, but this is a different way of being creative, of being artistic, because one, you're kind of using, it's totally visual for you. This is totally using, you know, your dexterity, using your hands. So was the transition difficult from one to the other?
No, not really. I always liked objects where you can, by just touching them, get a feel for the object.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of those things I really like is making mills, and people come and they pick them up and say, oh, this feels so good in the hand. And that's that's one of the main things that I like, and also that is one difficulty, because if you sell online, or if you don't really, if the customer can't really touch the object up front, that is a little, it's a step you really need to get used to.
Yeah, it takes away that tactile.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, well, where are your salt and pepper mills available?
I'm on my website, as you said, and then I go to trade shows. One of them coming up in this November here, being in Burlington, the Craft Vermont Show, which is, I think, November 18th through 20. And that is where I get also a lot of feedback from customers. They walk by and they say, oh, yeah, I like this, I like this. And that's when I do know where to go, which way to go, what styles people like. Some were sold in galleries, which was not so successful for me, to tell you the truth.
Mm.
I was in a gallery in Stowe, but it all depends if people can pick them up and touch them. And I'm looking into the thing that I might be offering people to buy them on the website and to return them if they don't like the feel of them.
Gotcha.
I haven't gotten there yet.
Well, Detlev, there is one that people can pick up and actually swing. This is the 34-inch baseball bat mill. How many of these do you make? Do you know of any major leaguers who own any of these pepper mills?
No, I sold several to baseball fans who really love the sport and who are having their friends around. And actually my wife came up with the idea, why don't you make a salt shaker? So it is a set. It is not very practical, to tell you the truth, because they're long and they tip over, but it was a fun thing to do.
Well, I think they belong on a bat rack. You pull it out, you know, add salt and pepper to your meal, and then put them right back up on the rack there.
Yeah, I took regular Major League Baseballs, hollowed them out, and made them into salt shakers.
Mm.
So you have your salt and pepper as a matching set.
Ah, you're having great fun with this. And I have to say, it's not just the combination of woods, which I find stunning, but these incredible designs. So how do you come up with all the different shapes that you're offering of these mills?
Occasionally, I just sit down and take a sketchbook and see what I think would look nice. I think that people should have a little bit of design and art in their regular lives on a day-to-day basis. So that basically, you sit there, you go, oh, let's try this. And a few of the designs, of course, don't work, but it is when you're a little bored and you don't have anything else to do, you think about what next shape you can make.
Mm-hmm. Do chefs or cookbook authors, serious foodies, seek you out for your mills?
I sold a few to customers that said, oh, my brother is a chef and he would love a nice pepper mill like this.
Yeah.
And he uses a lot of it. But it is people give those away as wedding presents or as housewarming gifts. And it's something which lasts a lifetime.
Right.
If you don't put it in the dishwasher.
That's highly recommended that you avoid doing that at all costs. And how about, do you do custom designs for people?
Yes, I do. I had several people ask me for certain colors and heights and shapes. And I also did a couple of corporate clients where they said, okay, I need 50 mils. They should be this tall. And they all should look different so I can give it away as presents to my customers. And so I'm basically doing whatever people come up with, and I'll try to make it work.
And I've got to ask you this. When you sit down and somebody makes you a meal, do you taste it first before you add salt and pepper?
Yes, of course.
Attaboy. Well done. You sound like you're having fun with this.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I have four different pepper mills in my kitchen. I got white pepper, I got black pepper, I have red peppercorn. So there are a lot of taste differences, and that's when you need three pepper mills instead of one.
You're absolutely right. Detlef Hunsdorfer owns Holzkopf, and to learn more, you can visit holzkopf-dh.com. Detlef, I want to thank you so much for sharing the story of these incredible pepper mills. It was great.
Thank you very much for having me on, and keep grinding.
Yeah, you got it. Great advice throughout life. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll be back to get thee to the funnery. And the Red Sox have the Baltimore Orioles at Fenway for one night only. Coverage begins tonight at 6:10, first pitch at 7:10. This is Ramon Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. A friend posted something on Facebook that caught my attention. It was something called Get Thee to the Funnery. And it's presenting Hamlet tomorrow and Saturday. And she wrote, do get to this. I was beyond intrigued, and I set off for the funnery. There I found Peter Gould, founder and director of Get Thee to the Funnery. And he was only too happy, giddy even, to be on the show. Peter Gould joins us now. Peter, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, my offense is rank. It smells to heaven and hath a primal eldest curse upon it, a brother's murder. Hi. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm rehearsing.
Well, I know we got the right guest here. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Peter about what makes Shakespeare so darn fun, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-TALK.
Well, I can open by saying that Shakespeare is a lot of fun, and maybe the first day of camp, some people who get sent by their parents are wondering, why am I here? But then, you know, within a half an hour or an hour, they realize that they're about to have the 2 weeks of the best fun that they've ever had in their life. And part of the fun is really understanding words that they were afraid of because they thought they were difficult. But
well, let's start at the beginning. What in the name of Ophelia is Get Thee to the Funnery?
Get Thee to the Funnery is a two-week Shakespeare program for young people in Greensboro now. I founded it in 1998, so this is our 25th summer. We've sometimes had as many as 40 kids, sometimes as low as like 25 or 26, and I have a great staff, all of whom have come up through the ranks of the funnery. Some of them have been with us for 15 years, and they just get with the program because they get what we're doing. And so in those 2 weeks, we encourage everybody who's there from the age of 12 to 18, did I say that, to expand and grow in their hearts, their minds, their bodies, and their voices. And then at the end, we do a couple performances of whatever Shakespeare play we're concentrating on that year. So like in 2020, we did it on Zoom, and that was Merchant of Venice. Last year, we did Midsummer Night's Dream, and we had some great discussions about climate change and global warming. This year it's Hamlet. We always have a theme too, because I just love to sit in a circle and hear what the young people have to say about issues that I'm thinking about. So this year with Hamlet, we're talking about grief and about revenge and about whether or not you should listen to ghosts if they bring you important news. And but it's mostly this year it's about grief and pain.
Yeah, I think the year you did the Zoom presentation. I saw it online, and the kids were talking about racial equity. And I got to tell you, they said things more intelligent than I did, and about their experiences and about their opinions. So,
well, that's
really
the
impressive.
That's the point. I've directed about 95 youth theater productions. About half of them Shakespeare, and sometimes a group of adults come and say, "Hey, we want to get this play. Will you direct us?" And I'm like, why would I want to do that? Because I really like working with young people.
Yeah. Why did you start this Shakespeare troupe up here in the Northeast Kingdom?
I was doing residencies in theater and clown and circus arts and juggling and physical comedy and mime in the schools all over the state. And I was also performing with Stephen Stearns, as Goulden Stearns. And I really liked being up here in the Northeast Kingdom. And I had just done a wonderful residency in Hamlet with sixth graders up in Canaan. So I signed on to do a similar residency at the Craftsbury School. And the teachers said, oh, we don't have time to let Peter in. Our kids have to study our curriculum. So, you know, the music teacher, Andrea Breitenbach, and I looked at each other and we said, fine, we'll wait till school is over. And that's how in 1998 that the camp got started. And suddenly we looked at each other and said, we have a summer camp here. We don't need to do this during the school year. But the important thing about that is that we do it now later on in the summer, and the kids get so pumped about learning, about, raising the intellectual bar that, just a few weeks later, when they arrive at school, they're infected by this desire to learn, and which infects the whole school. And we've heard anecdotally from school principals that they just love it when our Shakespeare campers arrive back at school in the fall.
Who are these kids who come to camp, and from whence do they come?
All right. Well, I started it because there wasn't much going on in the summertime for young people in this corner of Vermont. Now they have a whole lot more stuff going on. So this attracted kids from little middle schools, little high schools in small towns, all around the Northeast Kingdom, who looked around their own school and didn't see a whole lot of people who looked like them or felt like them or seemed like them or spoke like them. And then they would come to our camp and find, oh, there's this one person that I never even would have met if it weren't for this camp who was in a small town somewhere else. And there's lots of people here at this camp, who question their identity, who are gender fluid, who are fluid about lots of things, and they haven't gotten exactly what they need from the school where they are. That's not a put down of the schools.
Sure.
The schools and the teachers are trying that as best as they can. But they come to this camp to be with people who really remind themselves of each other, each other of themselves. Yeah.
So take us through what happens when they first arrive in either Chelsea or Greensboro and start down the path of funnery.
Well, the first thing we do is we just talk about the, growing in the heart and the mind, the body and the voice. We tell them that Shakespeare's not hard. We tell them that you're about to have a two-week experience where you're going to speak Shakespeare and the audience's, the jaws are going to drop down to the ground and say, I've never understood that speech until now. And I've never understood, how Shakespeare can be so current. And we do exercises for about an hour, yoga, breath exercises, voice exercises, some other things. Every single thing that we do is an activity that we've developed over the years. It's sort of unique to us, and they're all fun, and they're wacky, and the kids have to have a certain tolerance for whack if they're going to come to our camp. And then we sort of gently get them into the idea of, now we're a group, now we're an ensemble, we're going to start to split up into smaller groups called scenes, and we're going to block them, and we're going to rehearse them, and we're going to show our work to each other. So we have like three different people playing Hamlet this year, two different people playing the King, two people playing Ophelia. That means that we can rehearse a couple scenes at the same time. We wouldn't be able to do if there was only one Hamlet. And we gently push them towards the last two days, having like stumble through today, performance tomorrow evening right here at the Highland Center, and then the big Saturday afternoon performance in Craftsbury. But we tell them that, don't worry about it. This is not a camp it's not a performance camp. It's not even a Shakespeare camp. It's a leadership camp cleverly disguised as a Shakespeare camp. And I work all year long to make the camp happen. And one of the things I do is I edit the script. It's all Shakespeare. But as you know, Hamlet is very long. So we've got a version which is about 60%. And only the most serious Shakespeare scholars sitting in the audience would be able to see where we cut.
Sure.
So it's real.
I want to get back to the name, Get Thee to the Funnery. If that name was even one-tenth less brilliant, it would be groan-inducing. Were there other names that you considered before?
No, this is it. I mean, there was a quote today in the New York Review of Books, and it says, if only facts and context were enough to stop the Trumpian gaslighting, but this is an unprecedented moment in history. And there's this famous scene in this play of Hamlet where Hamlet gaslights Ophelia and says, I never loved you. And she says, you gave me to think that you did. No, get thee to a nunnery. And so when I first began to do these workshops in 1997 and 1998, the name presented itself, and now you can find it on T-shirts everywhere across the state.
Yeah. And as we said, the name sounds damn fun, but how serious are the exercises that you put your campers through?
They do expand their capacity. They will talk louder and clearer than they ever talked in their life. They will do yoga. They will learn how to expand their heart into almost the breadth and width of their wingspan from finger to finger, so that they can embrace the audience and make the audience feel like they're talking, being spoken to personally. But we invest in the kids. So we have like kids today, we're 12, and we hope that they come back year after year, because some of the exercises we do invite them to grow along with us for a number of years, so that somebody who starts out with a very small voice of a pipsqueak and an affect which is very low and not wanting to present themselves in public, over the course of 4 or 5 or 6 years of us, they become bombastic, but in a nice way, and they learn how to articulate, how to speak, and how to be heard, and how to be understood.
The confidence that must build in them.
I tell them this from my own heart, because I was a stutterer when I was a kid in school, and I never spoke in a group. I never did any public speaking. I never would recite, and it's been a long hard road for me to get to the point where, that was me then, but this is me now.
Oh, beautiful. And let's head to Eden and speak with Brian. Brian, how have you been?
Good. How are you doing?
Well, great.
That sounds like such a great program, and it's great in Craftsbury. I remember when I was a little kid back in the early 70s, I used to hang out a lot with Miss Jean Simpson, and she was a big promoter of the Shakespeare Festival. Actually, she used to dress up like Julius Caesar and be dragged through old home days on a chariot when she was in her 80s. There's a great history there, Shakespeare. But my big question, and this is a funnery, I really need your expertise. When I was a senior in high school, I wrote a paper, and it was about Hamlet. And basically my thesis was Shakespeare's biggest tragedy was a tragedy until the very last line. When the doors open, they say Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, to a room full of dead people. It passes from being Shakespeare's biggest tragedy to dark comedy, because it's just overkill, literally. And my teacher hated the thesis, but said the paper was well written. So I'm curious about your professional. It's very a funnery type topic.
Well, thanks, Brian. Go ahead, Peter.
I have to say that we work, actually, the rest of the staff and the company are working right now on that final scene. And I tell them honestly, this final scene has been satirized by many people, because there's like 4 dead bodies on the stage, and that there's news of the other 2 people who have been killed off stage. But I have to take exception. It's not really the last line. It's one of the last lines. But then it becomes so amazing, because, Hamlet is dying in the arms of his best friend, Horatio, and Horatio is weeping. And we've actually had students, campers, just crying so much in that last little bit that it makes it a really effective final scene. And they almost couldn't get their words out when they were saying, let 4 captains bear Hamlet like a soldier to the stage, for he was likely had he been put on to approve most royally. And so you get the feeling that not only did Horatio's best friend Hamlet die, but the whole kingdom of Denmark is not going to be able to experience what Hamlet would have been like as a king. And then the final line is, go take up the bodies and bid the soldiers shoot. And then we hear the sounds off stage of the salute, the gun salute. And it actually, whatever feeling the audience might have had, the suspension of disbelief, oh, too many bodies on stage, they lose it and they get moved. And we guarantee that. We absolutely guarantee that if you come and see the performance, you'll get past that simple objection you had that to this possibly satirizable point, and you'll go with the emotion instead, and you will be fulfilled.
Well, I do want to pick up on the other thing that Brian brought up, because this is your news flash on your website about Miss Jean Simpson. I'm so glad that he mentioned her. Please tell us about Jean Simpson and what your gang is going to be working on.
Right. So I got this grant, from the Humanities Council of Vermont and some other funders, and we're mounting an exhibition of Miss Jean Simpson next year. She did her first Hamlet in 1923. So next year will be the 100th anniversary. Mm-hmm. We did our first Romeo and Juliet in 1998. So next year will be our 25th anniversary. And we're mounting an exhibition at the Highland Center called What's Past It is Prologue. Because I kid you not, when we finished our first performance in 1998, two elderly women came up and said, oh, we're so happy that you're reviving the tradition of Shakespeare on the common. And I'm saying, revive? What do you mean? And over the past 25 years, I've explored this, and we've picked up where Miss Jean left off. And Brian, you should look at our website and get my contact information, because I'll come up with and interview you, because we're mounting an audio and video, and this grant has brought me into the attic of the Simpson Library in East Craftsbury, and the wonderful librarian Kristen Urey and I have been crawling around in the dust up there. We actually last fall got the key and opened up a closet that hadn't been opened in 60 years, and there in pristine shape were costumes that Miss Jean had used in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and they were haute couture and beautiful, and we're going to have those in the exhibition. And I actually, digging around a couple months ago in the attic, in a bag, I found the famous silver helmet that Miss Jean Simpson wore in 1923 when Edward Steichen took her famous photo of Jean Simpson as Hamlet, and we're using it in this year's play to put on the head of the ghost. And so we're gathering up history. It's going to be a wonderful exhibition. Rick, I'll probably want to talk with you about this next year. And we're getting grant support and community support. People are coming forward with home movies of Miss Jean. So, Brian, it really moves me so much that you actually knew her and worked with her and saw her performances, and we need to talk.
Brian, get in touch with me. Email me, and I'll put you in touch with Peter. I can't wait for the two of you to connect. You know, Peter, at the end of the camp, and for some at the end of six or seven of these camps, you know, what do you hope the kids leave with other than those cool T-shirts that you have?
Well, I bump into these people all over the state and in other places, and I ask them that question. I just asked Brennan Bach that question a couple of days ago. What did you take away from the years at the Funnery? And, you know, they tell me things like the ability to be flexible when you're asked to do stuff that really, you know, extends your range and pushes you. The voice exercises, the respect for the text, the love of the audience. And I've had parents come up to me and say, my boy talked at the town meeting. And he said some things that were very important to him, and he would never have said a word if it weren't for your camp. And that kind of stuff makes me feel really good.
Peter, we've got about a minute left. How is this all funded?
Every single person in the camp, every campers are on scholarship, because it costs me a lot more money to run the camp than it does that we get through through tuition.
Right.
Any theater runner in the state of Vermont would understand that. The box office doesn't pay for the whole thing. So we get grant support from the Pleasance Fund of Greensboro Community Church. We get funds from the Vermont Arts Council, from the Northeast Kingdom Fund, from the Craftsbury Community Fund, from Vermont Humanities. And even though I'm known around the state as a writer with my books, fiction and nonfiction, the truth of it is that I spend most of my time grant writing.
We didn't even get to your books, so we'll have to do that some other time. And we will have you back to hear about that beautiful exhibition you're going to have for Miss Jean Simpson. Peter Gould is the founder and director of Get Thee to the Funnery, and you can learn more about what they do and where they perform at GetTheeToTheFunnery.com. Peter, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Rick. Thanks for getting in touch with me and people out there. The performances are this Friday and Saturday, and then we go back into the woods. So come out and see them.
All right. Get them before they go back into the woods. We're going to break for news, and then we'll be back to check in with the national correspondent, Bob Ney. And today at 1, it's Mucho Mucho Greg Hooker El Grande in the full-blown three-hour version of La Escapada or The Getaway. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Sengary. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I'll be broadcasting from the Vermont Antique and Classic Car Meet at Farr's Field in Waterbury tomorrow. So for the second week in a row, national correspondent Bob Ney has kindly agreed to be on Thursday. Bob, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hello. How are you, Rick?
I'm great. And Bob, I promise next week we go back to our Friday schedule.
Oh, whichever day you want is good with me.
All right.
The news is so exciting these days, you just never know.
It is. Let's talk about what's going on. This news that broke about Iran and John Bolton. So what do we know about the plot to kill John Bolton?
Well, they have made a charge in this. Justice Department unsealed the charges actually yesterday, and it's against a member of the Iran Islamic Revolutionary Guard. Now, what's interesting about that is that the Iranians, as part of the whole negotiation of the nuclear deal, are trying to get the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps off of the terrorist list. And so now the Justice Department is saying, well, you know, a member of this group is the one who was going to attempt to get John Bolton assassinated. Now, the Iranian national wasn't going to come over here himself. What he was doing, he had connections, and he's known as Mehdi Rezaei is his name, and he was using interstate commerce from Iran to try to commit the assassination. Now, he attempted, allegedly, to pay somebody in the United States, now, the department doesn't say who, $300,000 to kill John Bolton in Washington, D.C. or Maryland. And you remember, Rick, when all of a sudden Secret Service was all over Bolton's house and everybody wondered why. Well, this is why. And Rezaei didn't say, you know, where it should be carried out, as long as it was carried out, and they wanted it to be video confirmed that Bolton was killed. Now, Bolton has been, John Bolton, an extremely controversial figure his entire life, frankly.
Sure. Yeah.
And when it comes to Iran, Bolton has been just completely obsessed his entire career with Iran, and has drawn the ire, obviously, to the point where now somebody within the Revolutionary Guard was trying to kill him. Mm-hmm. Now, Bolton is saying, well, this is the reason you shouldn't deal with Iran. Of course, Bolton didn't, even before this, wouldn't ever want us to deal with Iran. Now, Bolton, as you know, was terminated by Trump.
Right.
Because he had convinced Trump to get out of the Iran nuclear deal and that the Iranians would just be eating out of our hands. And, of course, a lot of us who have watched this for years, the whole saga, knew that wasn't true, except Trump in that case. And then Trump got angry with Bolton.
So how does this news, or does it have any effect on the current negotiations going on for this nuclear deal with Iran?
Well, it really shouldn't. Now, here's the problem with all of this. The member of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, and obviously this shouldn't be done. They shouldn't try to kill John Bolton, but somebody has. And so one of the Revolutionary Guards attempting to do this should not be the factor of how we all try to deal with Iran in the nuclear issue. Mm. You know, this can happen in any group. It could happen with an American trying to do something, to somebody else overseas. You have renegades and bad people in every society. So overall, even though this is not a good thing that happened, obviously, and it was terrible they tried to kill John Bolton, the talks should still proceed between all the countries. It's larger than just one Revolutionary Guard trying to do a bad deed.
All right. Let's move on to the inflation bill, or as we like to call it, Build Back Better Light. How does this compare to the original Build Back Better plan?
Well, it's, of course, way reduced because of Senator Manchin, the Democratic senator from West Virginia. I was asked about this bill so much this week by friends of mine that called and said, what does it really do? And I said, it's almost like Senator Schumer, the Democratic leader of the Senate, came forth and said, we won. We beat the opposition. We beat Manchin and Sinema, two Democratic senators, because forget the Republicans for a second. The opposition has been, for 2 years, Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema.
Yeah.
So the two of them managed, although Manchin, Rick, is more out front and was more the voice of this, although Sinema was, definitely a player.
No doubt.
But he reduced it to $700 and some billion dollars versus the $3.5 some trillion that the White House wanted. So it was extremely reduced. Some tax implications were changed, and some of the programs were obviously, reduced in it, too. And it goes back to take care of Obamacare and extend it for, a few more years. And then it has a lot of climate issue in it, 300-some billion for climate. It's got a little bit of tax ramifications here and there, with collecting some taxes, which a lot of people wouldn't disagree with on people, who are in the billionaire category.
Sure.
But there's a provision in it that is extremely controversial, and I predict you will be as time goes on. That's the 80-some billion going to the Internal Revenue Service for enforcement, which some people back in the bill said, oh, no, this is customer service. But I think enforcement's the more correct word. And the problem I fear with that is that many people that have studied these issues, I think, would agree that they're not really going to go after the big boys. They're going to go after more of the small businesses and regular citizens in trying to do this new enforcement because, frankly, they're easier targets than large corporations that have lawyers and accountants.
Well, there's no doubt the IRS could use better customer service, but $80 billion, yes. $80 billion is a lot of customer service.
I was just telling somebody yesterday, I said, it's sort of like, oh, hi, they're hiring these people to go, oh, hi, I'm here to help you. No, they're hiring them to go after you. Not to help.
I once got a call from the IRS and thought, I have the answer for them. And I told them my answer, and then they explained their answer. I'm like, oh, never mind.
What? Well, I've said that
and
to
I
the
wrote
government
the check.
A couple of times in my life, and they're like, no, we don't like that.
Yep, I just wrote the check. What's the timeline on this inflation bill?
It's kicking in certain categories. Enforcement, when it's enacted, will, take place to be instituted. But there are some other time frames on it. Some of it's next year. It'll take effect. Now, politically, because there's the enactment of the bill, which a lot of this is a timeline taking effect in 2023. Politically, I just, with what's happened with former President Trump and that whole front page, controversy, I just don't see that this bill is going to have a great impact to help with the elections on the Democratic side. Especially with what's going on with Donald Trump, it's kind of stepping on the whole message right now, because the press is obsessed, obviously, with the whole Mar-a-Lago.
And explain what that was all about, what that raid was all about.
Well, on the raid, And let me just give an observation. Sure. As you know, I've been through my own set of saga with the Justice Department, with the Abramoff scandal. And I tell people on the inside, we were told you all were going to be raided and this and that, but they asked for subpoenas, and then you give them information. And these raids, as they call them, they are not as common as one would think they are. You see them on TV. They're high profile. You see people taken out in their pajamas, handcuffed. You know, you think back about Epstein, and you think of all these high profile deals, which this obviously is one of the highest profiles in the country's, history. But they aren't as common as we think. Number two, it has to go through every single layer of FBI and Justice Department when it comes to these types of things, and a former president. So it had to be signed off by the Attorney General onto the judge. Normally, when justice gets to this point, where they actually do, a no-knock or a raid or a warrant, whatever which way you want to call it, when they get to that point that they show up at your place with 30 agents, it's normally, again, I say normally, the case where they have some ironclad information. I have suspicioned on this one there was somebody within the Trump organization that was working with the FBI. I've just suspicioned that. Yeah. Just looking at past cases, that have happened. So basically, lawyers had went early, and the archives said Trump had information. They sat down at Mar-a-Lago. They actually told him to lock a room up, a storage room, which then when the FBI came in, they broke that lock. But they took out 15 boxes of information from the archives that they thought should be there. And then that was kind of it. And then all of a sudden, this happens. So here's the bottom line of it. The Justice Department's in a little bit of a quandary here in the FBI because they have to say, what they have. They went to this kind of extraordinary measure.
Right.
And, Rick, the bottom line is if they don't have anything, Katie barred the door. Mm. It's not going to be pretty.
I would sure like some advice, Bob, on how I could be raided by the FBI and they could cart off a good 15 crates out of my apartment so I can downsize. So if
I have the same deal in my basement, maybe I should tell them
that's right.
With Jack Abramoff, who I got involved with in the scandal, maybe I should tell him he left some boxes down here. I don't know what's in them.
I'll leak some information to my people and see if we can make that happen. All right. National Correspondent Bob Day. Once again, I appreciate your flexibility and, of course, your perspective. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yep. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to hear from Rachel Hellman of 7 Days about the imported rainbow trout swimming around Vermont. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We know our brook trout are tough sons of guns, but are our rainbow trout tough enough? Not sure, but Vermont Fish and Wildlife are bringing in rainbows from the West Coast and stocking them in Vermont waterways. Here to tell us why is Rachel Hellman of 7 Days. Rachel, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. What is the usual type of rainbow trout that gets stocked in our lakes by the state's fish hatcheries?
Yeah, so up until 2008, it was the Wytheville strain of rainbow trout, but there was an incident in one of the hatcheries that caused that entire strain to die. And as a result, the state started stocking an Irwin R. Lee strain. And for the past, since 2008, that's been the strain that's been stocked. And there's been some complaints that it hasn't quite been hardy enough, which has led the state to try out this new strain, the Eagle Lake trout.
I didn't even know there were different strains of rainbow trout. What kind of differentiates it one strain from another?
Yeah, well, it's a very slight difference. It's a very small genetic variance. They're all still rainbow trout. So this decision to stock Eagle Lake trout instead of the Irwin R. Lee is based on some studies from other states, such as Maine, that have noticed that it might be able to survive better in cooler temperatures and warmer temperatures. I didn't know this before, but trout are pretty sensitive to water temperature, so that makes a big difference in their ability to survive a season.
Yeah, the water temperature does affect how much oxygen is in the water. And so colder temperatures, I think there's more oxygen.
Yeah.
Right. And higher temperatures, there's less. That's my biological, that's my whole repertoire right there.
That sounds right.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's why they like to, you know, if there's some shade, they like to hang there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. And so, I learned that in the Northeast Kingdom, there's a lot more, deeper bodies of water, which has caused the Irwin R. Lee strain to not survive quite as well. So that's a big reason why they're switching strains.
That makes sense. Why do these lakes and streams need to be stocked at all?
Yeah. So there are naturally occurring trout strains in bodies of water across the state of Vermont. But anglers and fishers definitely enjoy a good rainbow trout. We know it tastes pretty delicious. Mm-hmm. And there's some bodies of water that do not have trout in them. So for recreational purposes, the state stocks trout in these bodies of water. Most are of the put-in-stock variety, so they don't expect them to survive past one season, but they offer fishers all around the state the opportunity to catch some trout in the season.
Ah, gotcha. So as I was driving up Route 7 from Mass this past weekend, I passed a fish hatchery in Pownall, I believe. How many fish hatcheries does the state have?
You know, that's a good question. I think there's, it's definitely under 10. It's just a few. I think there might be three, but I'm not positive.
Okay. And other than trout, what other types of fish do the hatcheries raise and stock?
Yeah, they stock a wide variety. I'm just pulling up the exact ones.
Okay.
But yeah, it includes, I have a list.
Good. That list, like a fighting fish. Walleye, yep, the walleye.
Yeah, walleye, salmon, muskies, and then, of course, trout.
Okay. And how much do we spend on this exercise of, you know, raising them at a hatchery and stocking them?
Yeah, so we spend about $4 million on fish hatcheries each year, but the returns are pretty good. We make well over $20 million, according to the last study that was done in 2010 in recreational and tourism funds after.
And, you know, are there any problems that people have with stocking these hatchery-raised domesticated fish in our waterways?
Yeah, it's definitely a controversial topic. While the state does it as ethically as they can, claiming to them, they make sure to only stock in places that don't naturally have trout. There are some folks who believe that there should be no stocking because it brings a foreign fish into the waterways, which is, you know, provides competition for other animals and also can, you know, bring pollutants and disease. So it's definitely a controversial practice, but, you know, the state is what it sounds like doing their best to make sure that they're able to offer recreational opportunities for anglers who enjoy stocked trout and other fish while balancing, you know, the need to preserve waterways and ensure that the animals that already exist there are not being challenged.
All right. Let's see if we can get a quick call in from East Corinth. We've got Forbes. Forbes, go right ahead.
Hi. Good morning. Good
morning.
What are the spawning characteristics of the various trout? And is the brown trout the original trout?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I believe the brown trout is the one that's native to Vermont. So that's a fish that, is able to exist in a lot of the different water bodies here. And continues to thrive. And a lot of fishers enjoy and anglers enjoy fishing for brown trout. There's definitely a slight preference towards rainbow trout for some people. But, yeah, brown trout are out and kicking in Vermont.
Well, how are our rainbow trout faring overall in our waterways?
Yeah, overall they are doing pretty well. You know, I think that there's been a number of complaints and kind of write-ins surrounding the survivability of the most recent strain. But this is the first year that the department is trying out this new Eagle Lake strain. And while it's too soon to tell if the strain has been successful enough. They have asked anglers to fill out a survey if they fish in one of the 11 water bodies that has the trout stock. And early results are showing that next season they may try to let the fish, grow a bit more in the hatcheries before putting them out so that they have a better chance of survival. But I think there's a lot of excitement around the opportunity this new strain provides for fishers.
And this strain is that Eagle Lake trout. Tell us about the strain. What do we know about it?
Yeah, it's very, from the naked eye, there's not much you can tell different from the Irwin Early strain, which exists before. It is originally from Eagle Lake, California, which is in Northern California, which is pretty interesting that we have a fish that is, from there in our Vermont waterways. Anglers will be able to tell which fish they've caught, which trout they've caught, based on which ventral fin has been clipped. So I can't exactly remember off the top of my head if it's the left or right, but if you go to the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department's website, there's a picture that shows which ventral fin you can look at to see which of the two you've caught, because otherwise from the naked eye you have no way of knowing.
That's interesting. Now, Rachel, yeah, we did talk about, some people having a problem with the whole idea of hatcheries and stocking in the first place. But
yeah,
here we are bringing in the Eagle Lake trout from California. So, this is a time where we hear a lot about the dangers of introducing non-native or invasive species into our ecosystems. So does anyone have a problem with bringing in, these Eagle Lake trout from California to Vermont?
Yeah, no, I think definitely there is a movement among some anglers to, stop stocking. I think there's been increasing evidence over the past few years that it may not be the best of practice and the best use of money from Fish and Wildlife departments. But that's also maybe not the most commonly held view. I think a lot of folks believe, some type of balance of stocking, which has been a practice that's been used since the turn of the century, is something that, provides recreational opportunities. Yeah, I spoke with someone at the Native Fish Coalition, which is a national organization that, advocates for only having native fish in water bodies. And Bob Mallard, the executive director there, felt that the stocking of fish that are non-native presents, challenges to the native fish that exists there, and that, anglers should be aware of that and be thinking about environmental preservation when they're fishing.
Hmm. Where can anglers attempt to catch this new strain of trout?
Yeah, so there's 11 bodies of water that it is stocked all across the state. The full list is available on the Vermont Fish and Wildlife website. And also, if you check out the most recent issue of 7 Days, we have it laid out there as well.
And have you given it a try? Have you gone out in pursuit of the Eagle Lake rainbow trout yet?
I have not, and it's definitely high up on my bucket list now. I spoke with a few anglers and did try to sluice my way into a fishing trip, but unfortunately no one was available. I thought that would be really fun.
Have you? Do you fly fish? Have you ever tried it?
I haven't. And I have to say, after writing the story, I really want to.
Yeah.
A lot of the anglers I spoke with talked about how peaceful it is and how it really is a way to listen to the surroundings you're in and respond in a way that is very innate to our humanity. So I am definitely feeling inspired, and I'm going to try to fish by the end of the summer.
Good for you. You can read Rachel Hellman's story in this week's issue of 7 Days or at 7daysvt.com. Rachel, great having you on again. Good luck
great
with those rainbows. All right.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we're going to talk EVs. And coming up today at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. That's followed by the Midday News Service with Lee Cattell and Brady Farkas. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Should I or shouldn't I? How can I make this work? They're pretty pricey, but in the long run, do I save? What are the pros and cons? How do they perform, especially in the cold Vermont winter months? This is a snippet of the internal conversations people are having about electric vehicles right now. There's an event coming up on Wednesday that you really want to attend to get those questions answered. It's the Waterbury Leap Electric Vehicle Fest. And with me now to tell us about the event and to answer some questions about that you might have about EVs is Duncan McDougall, the Waterbury Leap Chair. Duncan, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. It's always a pleasure.
Always a great time having you. And Dave Roberts, also with us again. Dave is the Drive Electric Vermont Coordinator. Dave, great to have you back.
Thank you, Rick. It's good to join you.
Great. Now, listeners, if you do have EV questions or want to share your EV experiences, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, and you can email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Duncan, what is LEAP?
LEAP is Waterbury LEAP, the Local Energy Action Partnership. It's an all-volunteer group that's been going for almost 15 years now in Waterbury, and our mission is to help our neighbors be more connected with and learn more about renewable energy, energy efficiency, and emissions reduction opportunities. And we've done that over the past 15 years through dozens and dozens of free events where we bring the experts on a certain subject, whether it be heat pumps or solar or whatever, together with local folks and businesses that might like to learn about the subject and maybe move forward. And we are having, as you said, this Wednesday, August 17th, I think it's the fifth LEAP Electric Vehicle Fest. And as always, we're delighted to be working with Drive Electric Vermont, a fantastic organization, and to be collaborating with Dave Roberts.
And it starts at 5:30, going on at the Crossett Brook Middle School. What will be happening there on Wednesday, Duncan?
It's a free event, as always. All our events are free. And from 5:30 to 7 this Wednesday, we are going to be having probably at least 20 different electric vehicles on display. And so the owners will be there, happy to talk about their vehicles and their experiences using them. Dave Roberts from Drive Electric Vermont will be there, and he'll give a short presentation. Then people will have the opportunity to talk to Dave, talk to the owners about their cars. They're going to get information about incentives, tax credits, charging, operating costs, vehicle ranges, etc. There's going to be a range of electric lawn equipment there as well, and we're hoping to have some electric bikes there also.
Dave, why are you such a big proponent of electric vehicles?
A bunch of reasons. So I guess, first of all, with gas prices where they are these days, EVs can save quite a bit of money. So, you know, the more someone drives, the more they can save. If you're able to get on an off-peak electric rate from a utility, which many Vermont utilities are offering now, it's the equivalent of maybe $1 a gallon gasoline. So in this time when there's a lot of high prices, it can be really helpful to save some money at the pump. They have drastically lower greenhouse gas emissions and other harmful tailpipe emissions than gasoline vehicles, typical gasoline vehicles, and they're also just fun to drive. And that's something that we hear all the time, and if folks are able to come out to the event next week and speak to some of the owners, I think you'll find, you will hear that the owners really love the performance and just the driving quality experience that they have in their electric vehicles.
I think, Dave, that is the number one thing I hear from people who drive an EV is they, I guess, had low expectations about the performance, the peppiness, the pickup of what the vehicle was going to be like, and then they got in and they drove it. Are you hearing similar
Absolutely.
Things?
Absolutely. Hear that all the time, and certainly, you know, personal experience as well. And it doesn't you don't have to be driving the fanciest electric cars, you know, the really expensive ones to have that experience. The electric motors that are used in EVs have sort of instant torque. So as soon as you put your foot on the accelerator, you really feel it in the vehicle. They're sort of effortless acceleration. They're very quiet. So just a really nice driving experience.
And Dave, is there enough of a variety of EVs now, especially, you know, the type needed for Vermont mud seasons and winters?
Sure. I mean, we're looking forward to seeing more models. There's currently about 40 models available for sale new, and there are some additional models available in the used market that are no longer being manufactured. And many of those do offer all-wheel drive and higher ground clearance, which, of course, a lot of Vermonters look for mud season conditions and whatnot. So they're out there. We have on the Drive Electric Vermont website a vehicle comparison tool that will show all the models available, and you can filter to show, you know, just ones that have all-wheel drive. The prices are expensive. It's the case with any new car these days. Average selling price of a new car is around $40,000 right now. So, you know, all the chip shortage and supply chain issues that have persisted in the auto industry are continuing to make availability kind of tricky and challenging, but we'll be providing some tips to finding EVs, and hopefully some of those issues will be getting better in the coming months.
Duncan McDougall, why are you sold on this transformation to electric vehicles from gas-powered vehicles?
A variety of reasons, Rick. First of all, as Dave said, you can save quite a bit of money with them. You can save money not only through not paying high gas prices, but also electric vehicles have far fewer operating parts, and so the maintenance is much, much lower. You save a lot of money over time. But equally importantly, or perhaps more importantly, they have a very positive impact on the environment compared to gas-powered vehicles. And some people say, well, you need to factor in the manufacturing and the creation of the batteries and all that. But there have been studies done that show that even if you factor all of that in, electric vehicles still have far less negative impact than do gas-powered vehicles. And they are fun to drive. And one thing I should note is, while new cars tend to be more expensive, I encourage people to go to the Drive Electric Vermont website, where there is a list of all the cars available. And there are a number of cars after federal tax credit and Vermont incentives where you can get cars, new cars in the 20s or low 30s. So you can certainly find electric vehicles and plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, which are a mixture of gasoline and electric powered. You can find a number of them at very reasonable prices, and that's before you start saving on the maintenance and before you start saving on not having to pay for expensive gas.
And Duncan, at the event coming up on Wednesday at Crossett Brook, will those in attendance have the opportunity to test some of these EVs that are now on the market?
I'm not sure all of the owners are going to be able to offer, let you have a drive in the car, but certainly you can talk with the owners and talk with them about their experiences.
Gotcha.
And just to let you know the range of vehicles we have there, we're going to have some Hyundai, VWs, Rivian, Subaru, Mustang, Nissan, Prius, Chevy, Tesla, Kias. That's just a sample of the cars. As I said, we'll probably have at least 20 cars there.
Now, Dave, I think it's something you've each mentioned is that idea of maintenance compared to a combustible engine vehicle. So explain the difference, you know, why I would save on maintenance, what parts are missing, and how an EV is able to operate without these, whatever I have in my car. Here's my technical explanation of vehicles. But, you know, why this is so much cheaper in the long run as far as maintenance is concerned.
Sure. So, and especially as Duncan mentioned, there's two basic types. You have the all-electric vehicles powered solely by the battery, and then you have plug-in hybrids, which still have internal combustion engines. The engines get less use, so there's less wear and tear, longer intervals between oil changes. So there are still savings with plug-in hybrids, but really where we hear most of that is with the all-electric vehicles because they just eliminate the entire combustion engine, so you don't have oil changes to worry about. EVs, all electric vehicles, don't have transmissions, so there's just a lot fewer moving parts, less to go wrong. It's not to say nothing will ever go wrong. There certainly right. have been some things that have come up. There's a battery issues that can happen. But the batteries are warrantied for typically 8 years, 100,000 miles, and they are holding up quite well. So that's a question we get a lot is, you know, do you have to replace the batteries after 2 or 3 years? And there are some EVs on the road with over 200,000 plus miles still on the original battery. So it's going to depend a little bit on the individual vehicle, but overall the batteries are holding up quite well. And what all that means is, say, Consumer Reports has looked at this and estimated about $4,600 in savings over the life of an EV compared to a gasoline vehicle in terms of repair and maintenance costs.
And with a hybrid, Dave, when you're driving it, does it recharge the battery, or does the battery only get recharged by being plugged in?
It will. So with the plug-in hybrid specifically, it will. You can plug it into a wall outlet, just a standard 120-volt outlet, or you can get a higher voltage, what's called a level 2 charger, which is 240-volt, like an electric clothes dryer, and that will typically charge a plug-in hybrid in a couple hours. And then as you're driving around, as you use the brakes in the vehicle, that will use what's called regenerative braking, and it'll recover. It'll turn the electric motor into a generator, and it'll store some of that energy back in the battery. So it's a much more, especially if you're doing a lot of stop-and-go driving, it can be really super efficient in those conditions to recover some of that energy instead of just losing it to your brakes. Plus, you're saving some wear and tear on your brakes.
Mm. I'd like to meet the engineer who came up with that. That's genius. We're discussing electric vehicles and the Waterbury Leap Electric Vehicle Fest this coming Wednesday. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-TALK. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Do you know what people see when they Google you? Search engines don't always get it right. And when they're wrong, it's your reputation on the line. So what do you do when you don't agree with your search results? Call Reputation Defender at 800-401-6681. Reputation Defender by Norton is one of the most trusted names in online reputation repair. We have over a decade of experience in fixing people's search results, and we can help you too. Using cutting-edge approaches, Reputation Defender pushes unflattering information down to lower pages of your search results, where few people ever look. We also promote the good stuff so that it rises to the top, letting you put your best foot forward. Your good name is too valuable to leave to the whims of a Google algorithm. You owe it to yourself to take control with Reputation Defender. Visit www.reputationdefender.com or call 800-401-6681 for free advice on your situation. 800-401-6681.
Join WDEV and Rollin' the Joy this Saturday as we broadcast live from P&R Lumber in Wolcott for their annual Customer Appreciation Day. You can take 5% off all in-stock items, and each customer gets a free bag of kindling while supplies last. It's Customer Appreciation Day this Saturday from 9 to noon at P&R Lumber, Route 15, Wolcott.
Are you sick and tired of that constant pain in your knees or hips or back, especially this time of year? You need to be moving pain-free, right? QC Kinetics is helping people here every day, giving them lasting pain relief using the latest advances in regenerative medicine. The science is simple. They concentrate your own body's healing agents and apply them to your aching joints, restoring and repairing damaged tissue. With no drugs, no steroids, and no surgery, the old remedies for pain are not the only remedies. You need to learn more about how regenerative medicine at QC Kinetics can change your life. Make this the last summer you suffer from chronic pain. They have clinics here and all over America. This is the exciting new natural way to deal with joint pain with no side effects and no downtime. Call QC Kinetics now for a free consultation. 802 Painless, located right here in Colchester. 802 Painless.
Treatments are not yet FDA approved.
Attention
Chevy shoppers. At the new Lamoille Valley Chevrolet, business so far in 2022 has been awesome. Right, Pat?
That's right, Dan. And in August, we've set a goal to have our best month ever here at Lamoille Valley Chevy. With that said, the Big Dog Daddy year-end clearance sale is underway at Lamoille Valley Chevy. Folks, I want you to know that we have inventory here at Lamoille Valley Chevrolet. While many dealer lots are getting bare at Lamoille Valley Chevy, we have several new Chevy trucks and SUVs in stock and incoming, plus what I consider to be the finest selection of pre-owned cars, trucks, and SUVs we've ever had to offer you. And in order to have a record month in August, my Lamoille Valley Chevy team and I are going to make crazy deals all month long to earn your business. So come take advantage of the amazing deals from Chevrolet and our huge inventory of vehicles right now at Lamoille Valley Chevy and spread the word. At Lamoille Valley Chevy, we know price matters.
You heard Pat. Get a great deal at the Big Dog Daddy year-end clearance sale happening now at the new Lamoille Valley Chevy just past Stowe and Morrisville in the beautiful town of Hyde Park, Vermont.
The Bennett's family at Morrisville Used Auto, Route 15 east of Morrisville, has a passion for vintage vehicles. They got it from Joe more than 60 years ago and are happy to say it's lasted all this time. They deal in antique parts and memorabilia, sell newer model used cars and trucks, and offer top quality service work. Call Chrissy at 888-4981. And join the growing list of Morrisville Used Auto satisfied customers. And look for their flea market display at this weekend's Antique and Classic Car Meet on Farfield, Route 2, west of Waterbury.
How well does your garden grow? Tune in Saturdays at 12:30 for In the Garden with Peter Burke. Peter and co-host Joel Nashman give you one full hour of the latest news, helpful tips, and your calls to talk about what's happening in your garden. It's brought to you in part by Clausen's Florist, Greenhouse, and Perennial Farm in Colchester. In the Garden with Peter Burke, live Saturdays at 12:30. Hear the podcast anytime at WDEVradio.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. More and more automakers are offering more and more electric or hybrid models. But when does owning one make sense for you? We've got Dave Roberts and Duncan McDougall discussing these issues and letting us know about the Waterbury Leap Electric Vehicle Fest this Wednesday from 5:30 to 7 at the Crossed Brook Middle School in Duxbury. And to ask our guests an EV question or call us, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-TALK. And let's start with Dick in Waterbury. Hi, Dick. Go right ahead.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
I've been looking either at a fully electric or possibly a plug-in hybrid. But one thing that really concerns me, particularly if you were to go with a used vehicle, is the cost of replacement batteries. I've heard in some cases it's just not worth it in an older car. So how is that factored into the overall cost of ownership?
All right, Dick, great question. Duncan, what are we talking about when we go to replace a battery? I know Dave said earlier that, you know, they last longer than people had expected, but what is the cost of a replacement battery?
I'm actually going to pass that question to Dave, who
okay.
I think has more expertise on that.
Fantastic. Dave?
Yeah, so it depends on the vehicle and the size of the battery. So the longer the range EV, the more battery storage that's available in it, the more expensive it's going to be. So an older Nissan Leaf, which had a smaller battery, might be $5,000-$6,000. A relatively newer vehicle that has longer range, like a Tesla Model 3 with 200 to 300 miles of range, it might be closer to $10,000 to $12,000 if you have to replace it. So the good news is, as I mentioned, most automakers are offering 8-year, 100,000-mile warranties on the batteries. So, you know, if there's an issue, hopefully it'd be covered under warranty. They don't necessarily warranty it for, you know, 100% of the original capacity. So you expect to lose about 2% of range every year on an EV battery. So after 5 years, you might see about 10% less range than it was than it had when new.
Yeah.
With some of the older EV models, so Dick mentioned he's thinking about maybe a used vehicle, really important to get the battery checked out before purchase, particularly if anyone's looking at Nissan Leaf. That's very popular, really nice EV, but the batteries in those were smaller in those earlier years, so say 2011 to 15. And the battery pack in that particular model is air-cooled. So The air cooling isn't as efficient at pulling heat off the battery, and heat is one of the things that sort of ages the battery. Most other EVs have liquid cooling systems that are much more efficient at pulling heat off the battery pack. So if you're looking at an older Nissan Leaf, definitely go into it with your eyes open about the battery condition, and maybe think about there are some outfits that are sort of remanufacturing batteries or mm-hmm. starting to do that. So it might be, you know, replacing some individual cells in the overall pack, essentially, is what they're doing. So theoretically, that should be a much lower cost than replacing the whole pack outright.
Great question, Dick. Thanks for that. Let's go to Starksboro next. We've got Rich on the line. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Good.
I want to follow up on the question you asked earlier about regenerative braking.
Yep.
I don't think the guest specifically answered your question. Answered the question saying that plug-in electric, plug-in hybrid. Vehicles have regenerative braking, but it wasn't clear to me whether straight electric vehicles have regenerative braking.
Okay. Thanks for that, Rich. So, Dave, I think you answered that for me when I asked about the hybrid and, you know, if it recharges when we're driving. You mentioned that it does when we brake. Does that happen with a straight hybrid EV as well?
It does, and it's actually – that technology dates back to the original non-plug-in hybrid, so like the original Toyota Prius did have that ability. So it's sort of all the various types of EVs, including some of the non-plug-in ones, but all electric vehicles certainly do have regenerative braking, and it's really helpful for extending range. And one thing that I didn't mention with the plug-in hybrids – in addition to regenerative braking, they do sometimes, depending on the model and how you're driving it, they can use that gasoline engine to charge up the battery
okay.
as well.
Duncan, the state has set pretty high goals for the number of EVs it would like to have on the road. Are those goals realistic? Do we have the infrastructure available to power those cars?
I think the question might be, do we have the political will to meet the goals? And I think we're making some progress. Fortunately, some federal funds are coming in, and Dave knows more about this, where that's going to allow us to develop more charging stations and a bigger, broader network in Vermont, and that's a really important part.
Yeah.
But I think maintaining the incentives in Vermont is really important because this is a transition that that is essential not only to help us become more energy independent and to save folks money, but also to help our environment as well. So we still have a ways to go. We're not quite meeting the goals that we've set, but hopefully with some political will and some decisions on the statewide level, we'll be able to make progress.
Dave, how robust is that charging station network now? What efforts are being made to make it suitably available soon for people driving EVs?
Sure. Vermont has the highest per capita availability of public charging in the country. So we're doing okay, but there's certainly more work to be done. Most EV drivers will do most of their charging at home overnight, but you know, for tourists and visitors, and if someone's not able to charge at home, we definitely want to continue building out the public charging network. The state has been investing some of the Volkswagen diesel settlement funds in building out more fast charging along certain key corridors, and that is continuing this summer and maybe into next year. And when that initial work is done, no one will be more than sort of 30 miles to a fast charger wherever you are in Vermont. And the legislature appropriated another $10 million to support charging at multifamily homes and public locations just this past session. So that money will be flowing hopefully later this year into next year. And then, as Duncan mentioned, the federal government is also investing. Vermont's due to get about $20 million in federal funds to support building out charging initially along some of the federally designated EV corridors in the state, and that includes all the interstates, Route 7 south of Burlington and Route 2 east of Montpelier and Route 9 across southern Vermont. So there's definitely a lot of work happening, but If you're driving an EV today, I know some drivers are, you know, would love to see more, and it is coming.
But, all right.
For those who are concerned about it, plug-in hybrids are an option to consider.
That's Dave Roberts, the Drive Electric Vermont coordinator, and we have also spoken with Duncan McDougall, Waterbury Leap Chair, and the Waterbury Leap Electric Vehicle Fest is Wednesday at Crossett Brook Middle School from 5:30 to 7. You can go to waterburyleap.org to learn more. Dave, Duncan, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you so much, Rick.
You're welcome. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when I'll be broadcasting live from the Vermont Antique and Classic Car Meet at Farr's Field in Waterbury.